This is the third day of this November 2007 7-day Sesshin. And we'll go back to our text from the previous 2 days, the essential teachings of Zen Master Hakuin. We left off yesterday with his very imaginative, metaphoric account of the chronicle of Zen over the centuries, beginning with what he called the son of the Shakya clan, and moving up now through this master who, along with thousands of other monks, was forced to disrobe and go back to lay life, and gave his teaching as a ferryman. And that brings us to Japan, and this is where he resumes. Echoes from these sounds floating eastward landed in Japan. Sounds being his metaphor for the teaching, the Dharma. He starts with a stringless lute and the holeless flute and drums and all kinds of other things. These sounds floating eastward landed in Japan. They startled the golden cock, who clapped his wings and announced the coming dawn, while a jade tortoise sobbed out the sorrows of his heart. The footnote tells us this is based on words in a prophecy that Bodhidharma's teacher, Prajnatara, made when Bodhidharma was about to leave India for China. The golden cock was startled to learn that now Bodhidharma was taking the Dharma transmission that now Dayo was taking the Dharma transmission to Japan. The jade tortoise was sad because he was not there to carry Dayo over the seas on this important mission. I'm not sure who Dayo is. Oh, there's one national teacher called Dayo Kokshi. Anyway, Hakuin goes on. They brought fine spring warmth to recumbent mountain. They danced white flakes of snow over purple fields. They sent an auspicious herd of deer darting by so swiftly they made lightning seem slow, and made a bright pearl turn in emptiness with a brilliance that threw the surrounding world into total darkness. And then the footnote tells us this recumbent mountain refers to the first Rinzai Zen temple established in Japan. Yeah, it was founded by Dayo Kokshi on his return from training in China. And his line, Dayo Kokshi's line, became the main branch of the Japanese Rinzai school. The purple fields refers to Daitokuji Temple, founded by Dayo's heir, Daito. It's in Kyoto. This is still one of the principal training dojos in Kyoto. This allusion to the deer darting by refers to the teaching style of the Chinese master Wu Shui Tzu Yuan. He was invited to Japan by a certain shogun who built the Engakuji temple for him in Kamakura. That's one of the temples that Roshi Kaplo visited when he first went to Japan after the war. And at the opening ceremony, a herd of deer ran through the temple precincts. It was taken as an auspicious sign. And the temple was given the name Auspicious Deer Mountain. Here at Chape Mill, we have our own wildlife. We got a flock of wild turkeys that has been coming around a lot lately. But no evidence that they're fighting with the foxes that were always here. And the bright pearl here refers to a sub-temple of Daitokuji. From there, the music wafted into the flower fields of Hanazono. That's where the great Myoshinji stands, another one of the great training temples now in Japan. Eight sounds rang out in succession, striking everyone who heard them speechless. They worked like the great poison lacquered crocodile drum that destroys all within earshot. These eight sounds are just, we're told here in the footnote, refers to eight kinds of musical instruments. Branching out, it formed into four main pillars at Myoshinji, large instruments that yielded slow, resonant tones, and smaller ones that played with a quicker and more animated beat. Together, their voices rolled throughout the universe, penetrated far beyond the seas. These four pillars are were the four disciples of a master who was credited with restoring Myoshinji after its destruction in a war in the 15th century. One of them, one of these four, it's his lineage that Hakuin was affiliated with, his lineage and the Rinzai lineage. Hakuin goes on, "How sad to see music of such great purity and elegance forgotten, its place taken by these obscene noises pouring forth unchecked. Time-honored classics have been drowned out by the discord these vulgar, degenerate songs produce." And by that, of course, he means what he was raging about yesterday is the teaching of what elsewhere he calls dead sitting and silent illumination, where one is just complacently and smugly sitting while telling oneself that one is fundamentally enlightened. He goes on, "Look at the extraordinary caliber of the patriarchal teachers we have surveyed. How many people today bear any resemblance to them? Most of them have yet to pass through the barrier koans raised by these illustrious teachers, so the essential core of truth contained in them remains unpenetrated, and the fire still burns restlessly in their minds. They won't have a moment's peace as long as they live. They are like someone who suffers at daily intervals from chronic fever. They try to meditate for 5 days or so, then they give it up and begin prostrating themselves in front of Buddhist images. 5 days later, they give that up too and start chanting sutras. They keep that up for 5 days or so and then switch to a dietary regimen, one meal a day. They are like someone confined to bed with a serious illness who can't sleep and tries to sit up only to find he is unable to do that either. They stumble ahead like blind mules, not knowing where their feet are taking them. And all because they were careless at the start of their training and were never able to achieve a breakthrough of intense joy and fulfillment." It frequently happens that someone will take up Zen and spend 3, 5, perhaps 7 years doing Zazen, but because he does not apply himself with total devotion, he fails to achieve true single-mindedness, and his practice does not bear fruit. The months and years pass, but he never experiences the joy of nirvana, and samsaric retribution is always there waiting if he stops or regresses. And then he launches into several pages of raging at those who combine Zen with the Pure Land School, which, by the way, became commonplace in China, and great esteemed masters endorsed that combination. So Hakuin has his own way of seeing things. It isn't shared by everyone. What is common, though, among all realized teachers is the longing to see their students attain awakening. Teacher can't do it for the student. He or she can try to assist like a midwife, but in the end it has to be this has to come through the student. There's another chapter called The Difficulty of Repaying the Debt to the Buddhas and the Patriarchs. And he begins, Buddha means one who is awakened. Once you have awakened, your own mind itself is Buddha. By seeking outside yourself for a Buddha invested with form, you set yourself forward as a foolish, misguided person. It is like a person who wants to catch a fish. He must start by looking in the water, because fish live in water and are not found apart from it. If a person wants to find Buddha, he must look into his own mind, because it is there and nowhere else that Buddha exists. Question. In that case, what can I do to become awakened to my own mind? And then apparently this is the answer. That's a labeled answer, but here's where he picks up. What is that which asks such a question? Is it your mind? Is it your original nature? Is it some kind of spirit or demon? Is it inside you? Outside you? Is it somewhere intermediate? Is it blue, yellow, red, or white? You see here, he turns the questioner back to his own mind, to the questioner's own mind. What is that which asks such a question? He goes on, it is something you must investigate and clarify for yourself. You must investigate it whether you are standing or sitting, speaking or silent, when you are eating your rice or drinking your tea. You must keep at it with total single-minded devotion. and never, whatever you do, look in sutras or in commentaries for an answer, or seek it in the words you hear a teacher speak. The teacher's words are just pointing to what is one's own mind. They're like a finger pointing to the moon, and never should be misunderstood as the moon itself. That's why the best thing you can do after Taisho is to forget it. Forget it! Whatever may have seeped into the mind or caught your understanding is done. And to chew over the teacher's words is to miss the direct seeing into one's own nature. He goes on, when all the effort you can muster has been exhausted and you've reached a total impasse, and you are like the cat at the rat hole, like the mother hen warming her egg, it will suddenly come and you will break free. The phoenix will get through the golden net. The crane will fly clear of the cage. This total impasse, when you have reached a total impasse, this is the key thing. In working on Mu or a first koan, we have to reach the point where we can't avoid it anymore. We're boxed in, because it is just that impasse that forces us to go beyond ourselves. The problem is that it can, this sense of an impasse can work in the wrong way. If one is feeling in this desperation, this desperate impasse, some people whose karma hasn't ripened yet, well, instead of using this to vault over the koan, to launch oneself into a renewed, even greater effort, they will pervert this and turn it against themselves as follows. What's wrong with me? I've been at this so long. What is wrong with me? There's got to be something. This is too much for me. It must be too much for me. I see other people who have not been practicing as long. I see them getting through. And here I am. This is the most corrosive misuse of this wonderful opportunity of being at an impasse. It's turning away from this opportunity and crippling it. Instead, if one can say, even what is going on here? I see other people getting through. Why can't I do this? I can. I will. Whatever it takes. What one person can do, anyone can do. This is how to use that sense of desperation. not having it fold in on itself and go in this destructive direction. But you have to have the faith in yourself. And you have to reject the train of thoughts that take you off in that wayward direction. You have to leave them alone. Don't go there. He goes on, but even if no breakthrough occurs until your dying day, and you spend 20 or 30 years in vain without ever seeing into your true nature, I want your solemn pledge that you will never turn for spiritual support to those tales that you hear the down-and-out old men and washed-out old women peddling everywhere today. If you do, they will stick to your hide. They will cling to your bones. You will never be free of them. And as for your chances with the patriarchs difficult to pass koans, the less said about them the better, because they will be totally beyond your grasp. Well, he doesn't say explicitly what he's referring to here with these those tales that you hear, the old men and old women peddling everywhere. I suppose it's what we already said. This Buji Zen. There's nothing to do, nowhere to go, no reason to raise an effort. We've all been enlightened from the very beginning. It's true, by the way. All of that's true. But it can be true, and we can commit ourselves to awakening to that truth. I suppose contemporary versions of these tales that you hear about would be the enticements that you see and popularized in again Buddhist magazines, of these claims of coming to enlightenment in 3 days or whatever. This is garbage. Often it's just a marketing device. He goes on, hence a monk of former times, Cao Feng Yuan Miao, said, a person who commits himself to the practice of Zen must be equipped with three essentials: a great root of faith, a great ball of doubt, a great tenacity of purpose. Lacking any one of them, he is like a tripod with only two legs. And then Hakuin elaborates on this. By great root of faith is meant the belief that each and every person has an essential self-nature he can see into, and the belief in a principle by which this self-nature can be fully penetrated. Even though you attain this belief, you cannot break through and penetrate to total awakening unless feelings of fundamental doubt arise as you work on the difficult-to-pass koans. And even if these doubts build up and crystallize, and you yourself become a great doubting mass, you will be unable to break that doubting mass apart unless you constantly bore into those koans with a great burning tenacity of purpose. Thus it is said that it takes three long kalpas for lazy and inattentive sentient beings to attain nirvana, while for the fearless and stout-hearted, Buddhahood comes in a single instant. What you must do is to concentrate single-mindedly on bringing all your native potential into play. The practice of Zen is like making a fire by friction. The essential thing as you rub wood against stone is to apply continuous, all-out effort. Continuous, all-out effort. If you stop when you see the first sign of smoke, you will never get even a flicker of fire, even though you keep rubbing away for two or three kalpas. One way to understand this, stopping when you see the first sign of smoke, would be coasting when you reach a state of great quiet, where the mind is still and you feel you're in a state of emptiness. Those who are less than fully committed are tempted when this happens to slack off and to just not persist as needed. But Hakuin more likely here, when he says if you stop when you see the first sign of smoke, he more likely means if you stop at a when your first kensho, when you at the first at first entering the gate. Or maybe not. He says you will never get even a flicker of fire. Maybe that's the kensho. He goes on, only a few hundred yards from here is a beach. Suppose someone is bothered because he has never tasted seawater and decides to sample some. He sets out in the direction of the beach, but before he has gone 100 paces, he stops and comes back. He starts out again, but this time he returns after he has taken only 10 steps. He will never get to know the taste of seawater that way, will he? But if he keeps going straight ahead without turning back, even if he lives far inland, he will eventually reach the sea. By dipping his finger in the water and tasting it, he will know instantly the taste of seawater the world over, because it is, of course, the same everywhere, in India, China, the Southern Sea, or the Northern Sea. But taste it, one must. It's not enough to hear about it. I think every practitioner would come to realization if she or he persisted long enough, eventually. The trouble is people get sidetracked. They get swept up in their busy lives, attending to so many things they can't find time to sit. They stop going to Sesshin, and Sesshin becomes this distant memory. And then one forgets the power of Sesshin, which just means the power of Zazen. One forgets. One forgets what it reveals about our nature, our energy, our potential, the clarity, the buoyancy of the mind. Without doing intensive Zazen, we can forget this. And the memory recedes, and we find all kinds of reasons to do other things with our time. He goes on, those Dharma patricians who explore the secret depths are like this too. They go straight forward, boring into their own minds with unbroken effort, never letting up or retreating. Then the breakthrough suddenly comes, and with that they penetrate their own nature, the nature of others, the nature of sentient beings, the nature of the evil passions and of enlightenment, the nature of the Buddha nature, the God nature, the Bodhisattva nature, the sentient being nature, the non-sentient being nature, the craving ghost nature, the contentious spirit nature, the beast nature. They are all of them seen in a single instant. He's cataloging here the different realms, the different realms of unenlightened existence. The great matter of the religious quest is completely and utterly resolved. There is nothing left. They are free of birth and death. What a thrilling moment it is. You know, this, all of this raging that Hakuin does, I remember when Roshi used to read this in Taisho, I used to think, could someone give him some medication or something? Jesus Christ, give us a break. You know? But this force of his teaching comes from the most profound compassion, his longing to have everyone have this experience, to taste this joy. You can hear him just crying out with compassion for the needless suffering of sentient beings. He's just marshaling every word, everything he can come up with to inspire students to make their greatest effort, to not relent, not to give up, not to falter in their faith in themselves, not to give way to doubts. He goes on, it is with great respect and deep reverence that I urge all you superior seekers who investigate the secret depths to be as earnest in penetrating and clarifying the self as you would be putting out a fire on top of your head. To be as assiduous in boring through your doubt as you would be seeking a lost article of incalculable worth. Don't think the commitments and pressing duties of secular life leave you no time to go about forming a ball of doubt. Or sitting, we could say. Don't think your mind is so crowded with confused thoughts you would be incapable of devoting yourself single-mindedly to Zen practice. This is another one I get from people sometimes. Oh, my mind is such a mess. I'm so confused. I'm so hopeless. Blah, blah, blah. I once tried that with Roshi Kaplow, and without even looking up, he said, your mind isn't different from anyone else's. This is the ego, and it's at its most pernicious, where it convinces us that we are in some basic way, let's say I am in some basic way different from everyone else. Other people get through their koans. Other people have breakthroughs. But me, little me, whine. It's such, it's the ego. It's just, you can just see it's like a demon sitting on the shoulder of that person, you know, cackling away. You have to notice when this is happening. Don't be taken in by that garbage. There's no one here who can't experience this. He goes on, suppose a man was in a busy marketplace, pushing his way down a narrow street in a dense crowd, and some gold coins happened to drop out of his pocket into the dirt. Do you imagine he would just leave them there, forget about them, and continue on his way because of where he was? Do you think someone would leave the gold pieces behind because he was in a congested place or because the coins were lying in the dirt? Of course not. He would be down there pushing and shoving as much as he had to, frantically turning everything upside down, with tears in his eyes. His mind wouldn't rest until he had recovered them. Yet what are a few pieces of gold set against the priceless jewel found in the headdresses of kings, that way of inconceivable being that exists within your own mind? Could a jewel of such worth be attained easily without effort? This is an analogy that may escape some people, maybe a little hard to relate to. And like any analogy, it's not a perfect one, because here what he's describing is a state of craving those gold coins. And striving to know mu, to awaken to one's true nature, is not the same as craving. It's not wanting to get something for oneself. It doesn't need to be, anyway. At its purest, at its understood as it really is, it is a longing, a desire to awaken for the sake of all sentient beings. Not to get something for oneself. To realize this wisdom and compassion that is our nature, to realize it in order to be able to give to others, our family, our work, suffering beings everywhere. It's not craving. This is the most profound wish of any human being, to be of service. To become a vehicle by which we can help others. There once was a denizen of the eastern sea. Here we go again. He's off and running. A redfin carp by name, who was endowed with an indomitable spirit and an upright character. Redfin carp was a figure of immense stature among his fellow fish. He was constantly bemoaning the fate of his comrades. How many untold millions of my brethren proudly dwell in the vast ocean deeps? They entrust themselves to its boundless silver waves, glide up and down among the swells, and sport in the seaweed and kelp. yet countless of them are taken by baited hooks and caught in nets. They wind up on chopping blocks, where they are sliced and cooked to fill the bellies of those in the human world. Their bones are cast away and left to mingle in the dust and mire. Their heads are thrown to the stray dogs. Some are dried or salted for inland markets, exposed in stalls and shop fronts for all to see. Not a single one finishes out his natural span. How sad is the life of a fish! Amid these sad musings, which, by the way, were Hakoen's own musings, his own laments, amid these sad musings, there was a great welling of spirit in Wet Redfin Carp's breast. He pledged a solemn vow, "I shall swim beyond the dragon gates. I shall brave the perilous bolts of fire and lightning. I shall transcend the estate of ordinary fish and achieve a place among the order of sacred dragons. I shall rid myself forever of the terrible suffering to which my race is heir, expunge every trace of our shame and humiliation." Waiting until the third day of the third month, when the peach blossoms are in flower and the river is full, he made his way to the entrance of the Yew barrier. Then, with a flick of his tail, Redfin Carp swam forth. You men have never laid eyes on the awesome torrent of water that rolls through the dragon gates. It falls all the way from the summits of the far-off Kunlun Range with tremendous force. There are wild 1,000-foot waves that rush down through gorges towering to dizzying heights on either side, carrying away whole hillsides as they go. Angry bolts of thunder beat down with a deafening roar. Moaning whirlwinds whip up poisonous mists and funnels of noisome vapor, spitting flashing forks of lightning. The mountain spirits are stunned into senselessness. The river spirits turn limp with fright. Just a drop of this water will shatter the carapace of the giant tortoise. It will break the bones of the giant whale. It was into this maelstrom that Redfin Carp, his splendid golden-red scales girded to the full, his steely teeth thrumming like drums, made a direct all-out assault. "Ah, golden carp! Golden carp! You might have led an ordinary life out in the boundless ocean. It teems with lesser fish. You would not have gone hungry. Then why? What made you embark on this wild and bitter struggle? What was waiting for you up beyond the barrier?" I would just say that here, it teems with lesser fish. You would not have gone hungry. Could be, you could have so much in the world, so many riches, wealth, position, power, the perfect family, the perfect house. Why? What was waiting for you up beyond the barrier? Suddenly, after being seared by cliff-shattering bolts of lightning, after being battered by heaven-scorching blasts of thunderfire, his scaly armor burnt from head to tail, his fins singed through, Redfin Carp perished into the great death, and rose again as a divine dragon, a supreme lord of the waters. Now, with the thunder god at his head and the fire god at his rear, flanked right and left by the gods of rain and wind, he moves abroad with the clouds in one hand and the mists in the other, bringing new life to the tender young shoots withering in long parched desert lands, keeping the true Dharma safe amid the defilements of the degenerate world. Had he been content to pass his life like a lame turtle or blind tortoise, feeding on winkles and tiny shrimps, not even all the effort and the other dragon kings might muster on his behalf could have done him any good. He could never have achieved the great success that he did. We'll have to stop there and recite the four vows.